3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 2.
The Little Hometown. Without some kind of sketch of my birthplace, drawn from the depths of memory, it might be difficult to understand the background of my literary work, so I insert such a picture, fraught with much pleasure to me, at least. Perhaps it also brings back memories to some other old natives of Carisbrook as well. This little town in the heart of Victoria nestled at the junction of Deep Creek and McCallum's Creek. Rocky Bald Hill and Charlotte Plains to the east, and to the north and west the gold-bearing ridges of Maryborough and its satellite townships. Carisbrook had been designed as the chief town, but high land values drove the people out, and with the population our glory departed to Maryborough. For decades there was rivalry between the two places. We ardently hated those Maryborough bosses and delighted to lick them at games or anything else. But now the Brook is a sleepy little village where old-timers may rest, with very rare upstirrings of the spirit of the inhabitants. Yet glory we did have at one time. Just recall the courthouse. Naturally, that shrine of justice was not without its unwilling devotees. Sometimes the old boys would have a spree and find themselves in the logs next morning. There was a story of two such, father and son, reaching the same refuge on the same night, and the father's wailings at daybreak when they awoke to find each other. "Ah, dinny, me boy, that I should find ye here! Och on, och on! Locked up for too much of the creature! Sure ye'll break the heart of your mother, and bring blushes to your father's face when he comes before his honour." And so the lamentations went on. Not far away from the Temple of Justice was the town hall, home of magic wonders. The picture addict of today knows nothing about thrilling entertainment, since he never entered the town hall in the 70s and 80s of last century. In that auditorium, visiting companies staged varieties. Rowdy political meetings left much rubbish to be cleaned up next morning. Lectures and concerts and local talent called folk together, and the boys understood the art of applause. Some may recall a lecture by the Reverend Ralph Brown, Heads and Faces, it was called, at the conclusion of which the lecturer invited subjects from the audience to volunteer for a public head reading. One of these volunteers was a member of the gentler sex, and among other things she was described as amative. That is, the lecturer explained, she had great attraction for the opposite sex. Then broke forth a roar of mirth which astonished the lecturer, for he did not know that the lady being red had a reputation like that of the woman from Samaria. Any old Carisbrookite will remember the blue ribbon meetings in the town hall. Their ostensible purpose was the spread of temperance principles, but in the light of wider knowledge, I fear these gatherings did more for budding musicians and reciters in our midst. How wonderful were these performers, at least our Mary and our Bill, whilst we would sniff with contempt at Jack and Sarah from a rival family, who either sang like a bee in a bottle, or bleated like Mother So-and-so's billy goat. Storms raged around these rivalries, but now it is all a quiet and rather humorous recollection of our youthful days. We also had our local nigger minstrel shows, organised by some of the young men. The population flocked to the town hall on the occasion of these shows, simmering with excitement, for nobody could guess which of our townsfolk would be the butt of Mr. Bones. The idiosyncrasies of any one of us might be aired before the snickering audience, and the victim dared not take offence. But I recall the gusts of laughter over Dave Ronayne's burlesque of the plaintive American songs the troupe was wont to sing in the fashion of that time. One reason why I can revert so clearly to those entertainments was the imitations by my brother Steve, for he was a splendid mimic and a typical boy who filled our little house with the clicking of homemade bones, making his performances the most realistic by blackening his face. If entertainment is joy and laughter and rich anticipation beforehand, then nothing could excel what we had at those simple amateur concerts in the town hall at Carisbrook. We had a brass band, too, in which my father took a prominent part. It would enliven the town on all public occasions, blast defiance at election rallies, and march in the solemn procession at the funeral of any citizen of note. It provided the cultural element for many who found no other outlet, and was a sound expression of the public spirit of the inhabitants. And the dances, with Mr. Jim Hurd as MC, they were the chief joy of all the young girls. Of those who were old enough to attend, of course, for some of them, like my older sister, had Puritan parents who frowned on such worldly frolickings. Naturally, a scandal came to light when it became known that a rebel or two had slipped out late at night to the quadrille party, exit by the bedroom window. We Puritan maidens had to be content to display our finery at the Sunday school anniversary. There were four flourishing churches, each a social centre as well as a spiritual lighthouse. Apart from a little bigotry, we all met as neighbours, and the general effort was always upwards and towards better things. There was, however, a slightly primitive touch amongst us, for we did not like strangers, by which I mean newcomers. For about 20 years, the mining had definitely shifted to the northwest, leaving a small population devoted to farming and gardening, with enough tradesmen and shopkeepers to serve the others. An exclusive society had developed, so that when deep mining began, and there was an influx of rovers seeking work of this kind, we did not feel particularly cordial towards them. They were mostly Cornish and Welsh, while the settled inhabitants were English or Irish, with a sprinkling of other nationalities. We resented the invaders almost as much as if they had been enemy aliens, and laid many things to their charge. They were shameless borrowers. They kept those abominations, coursing dogs, and wickedly went hunting on Sundays. They also had multitudes of goats, which devoured every green thing in sight. Now, in former times, all of us had kept the useful nanny for our milk supply, but the 70s had found us more prosperous and in possession of a cow. Therefore, we hated the goat, against whose ravages no garden fence could protect us. The starved dog was even more odious. Nothing in the shape of food was safe from it. If mother left a dish of boiled bacon on the bench at the back to cool, a lithe form would leap over the fence, snatch the joint, and vanish in a flash. Through the kitchen door would come a long-legged streak, and away would go our loaf of bread or a slab of mother's toothsome dripping cake. Oh, those cousin Jacks and their thieving greyhounds were the bane of our lives. And was it they who rose in the dark hours of the morning and milked our cow dry for us? Who was it that cleaned up our apricot tree in the night, just before our annual supply of that favourite jam was to be made? And who got off with our firewood, chopped by my brother, ready for the Saturday cooking? Who knows, I ask. We thought we knew, but did we? I imagine now that it must have been one black sheep family all the time, and may we be forgiven if we falsely imputed these unsocial acts to any innocent person. The Carisbrook folk were not without sports. The children wandered in the bush and learnt to play with flower chains and bark whistles, to ride a rocking bough or trail a sapling hobby horse. Thus we became very intimate with nature and gathered treasures of knowledge of the life around us, both in the animal and vegetable kingdoms. In the days of our childhood, the creeks were beautiful with their red gums, their rushes, and their water lilies. And there the men angled for the tasty blackfish, and the boys filled buckets with yabbies or crayfish, or haunted the swimming holes in spite of occasional accidents. The sharp crack of the sporting gun echoed over the rises, resulting often in a rabbit or hare for the table, or a delicious parrot pie. Thus, in contact with nature, our children grew robust and hardy, getting ready for the strenuous time that must come to all in later years. Of course we had organized games, and our fire brigade under the captaincy of Mr. Jim Hurd. When fires broke out, our gallants were all ready for such emergencies with their primitive equipment, and many a good save was made, in spite of the pine box style of house which sheltered most of our families. Such was the general mixture of life at the common level in the little home town. But as in other places, there were some that did not belong to the common level. We had some derelicts, well below the surface. Of these I gave a picture in my book Old Timers, although in that little volume it was rather the type than the individual which was presented. At the opposite end of the scale was the thin rank of men and women who rose like cream on milk to offer their richer qualities to the community. Many of them sought the city and rose to distinction. Do not forget that Carisbrook had seen Billy Barlow in his comedy acts, and the camels of Burke and Wills through the town on their fateful journey. And we had orators who arose at meetings and talked themselves into trips to Melbourne to demand from the government an improved railway service or a new water supply. Any of my fellow townsmen at that time will agree, however, that the outstanding local man was Collie Clarkson. His name has been given to nothing better than a mud hole near the station called Lake Collie, and probably he has never been heard of outside the district. Friends as he was to all, and a real power amongst us. Officially, he was town clerk and registrar of births and deaths. He and his family lived behind a wonderful shop, where we could buy beads and balls and pens and papers and toys of all descriptions, penny lines in particular, and the knick-knacks of fancy work, dear to the heart of the young missus. Collier Clarkson sang a lusty bass in the Wesleyan church choir, was, in fact, to the fore in everything. But these statements do not convey any impression of the kindliness and outstanding wisdom of this man. To him went all who were perplexed and troubled. The law was known to him. He could make a will or draw up a contract, and the buying of land mining shares and similar subtleties gave him no worries. Those who went to him were never rebuffed. He helped my mother when her husband died, and to me, as to other young orphans, he was a friend and father. Patriarch is the best title I can think of for him. And when he grew old and feeble, the community was left like a flock without a shepherd. I should like to drift along, writing of many fine, sturdy families in and around our town, but this chapter, which is intended to exhibit the background of my later experiences, will not hold the complete story. However, I cannot deny myself the right of a little boasting about my first earthly abiding place. It shall be brief. Carisbrook has shared its cream with the outer world, and here is mention of a few. We gave this land a bishop in the work of George Merrick Long, a worthy Presbyterian divine in Lewis Hurst. This last family also contributed a medical man in Dr. Walter Hurst, whose name, by the way, was used to be spelt H-A-R-S-E. Likewise, we gloried in the successful career of the two Fricks, one as chairman of the County Roads Board and the other as secretary of the Treasury. These two claimed my special pride, as we Fricks and Astons derived from the same great-grandparents. Deputy Postmaster Kitto, though not born within our boundaries, was reared there and thus gives us a claim. There were many other citizens who did more than a citizen's job for their country, too many, I regret to mention here, but perhaps some of the old hands have a little pride in recalling their blind author and poet, who is also devoutly thankful that she was born in a spot where so many good things could enter her soul, and perhaps be preserved in writing for the time when such pioneer towns are wiped away from our land. My dear little hometown, my heart is filled with pleasure when in thought I ramble there, gathering flowers, paddling in the creek, and sharing the games of the children who were our neighbours. Then came the day of leave-taking, when I must come to Melbourne for education, and only vacation visits remained to keep alive the impressions of my first 8 years. Playground. Although we children often wandered afield to the bush, or to the clear, cool waters of the creek, my own favourite playground was the garden about our home. I cannot resist the sweetness of recalling it here, even if my readers find the picture trifling and dull. If you happen to be driving through the little town of Carisbrook, you will pass the spot where I was born. The house, now vanished, was a shop and dwelling opposite the Wesleyan Chapel, quite a humble abode in its quarter-acre garden. Grapevines grew on a framework at the side, making a veranda-like shade over door and windows. And other buildings, far from elegant, presented a rather rugged face towards the road. But behind these, oh, here was my childhood's Eden. My parents loved a garden, and everything grew for them. Come with me and behold the magic of it all, as memory paints it for me. First was the dairy, covered with a great sprawling cloth of gold rose, from which we gathered a perpetual supply of cream and butter-coloured buds, ever welcome as gifts for neighbours who loved beauty. Along the side fence were lilac, laburnum, and banksia rose, each in turn making a glorious show of colour, both in-house and garden. At the lower corner stood a spreading elder, and it provided its seasonal joys of snowy blooms, red ripening berries, and glossy black clusters of the late autumn fruit. These were always left for the bird feasts, for we had too much fruit of a more desirable kind to tackle the acrid berries, and our no-alcohol principles precluded the making of wine from them. Another part of the garden was Mother's special care. Here would be found crocus, daffodil, and hyacinth, whose remote ancestors grew in her garden of girlhood in Gloucestershire, and with them all kinds of fragrant herbs, balm, thyme, mint, rosemary, and verbena, supplied our pot herbs and scent for the linen box. Ivy, jasmine, and honeysuckle were there too, a crowd of perfumed courtiers where my mother was queen. And these were not all. Springtime had its stocks and wallflowers, anemones and poppies. In a quiet corner, honesty whispered to love in the mist, and the bleeding heart drooped sad and lonely. But perhaps the pride of place was held by a clump of primroses, reminders of the lanes and meadows of the Forest of Dean, and geraniums bent above them to shield them from our summer sun, glowing too fiercely for those tender plants of the old world. And what of Mother's violets? They were of the small, dark blue kind, all crumpled-looking, but richer in perfume than any of the queens and duchesses of the present-day violet family. I loved to recall the neat borders in which they grew, shimmering with purple bloom above the dark green foliage. Father also had his plot. He loved flowers, but was responsible for the welfare of his family, so his treasures were crisp cabbage and lettuce, rows of carrots and turnips, and pale marrows of a creamy texture that went well with our lamb or beef. Neither did we disdain the homely sprout or turnip tops, especially when boiled with a chunk of home-cured bacon. A few trees provided the necessary fruit, but most of this kind of food came from another garden, which we had planted near the junction of the creeks, and on which my father laboured incessantly during the later years of his life. This was the Eden I lived in, and my pastimes were those of the country child. I could make small flutes from the young stems of the elder, squeakers from the wild barley, tiny windmills of straw which would turn slowly in the hand, umbrellas from thistledown blooms, chains of capeweed daisies, all amused me in that small sanctuary behind our house. I was rich if I had a golden beetle, shells from the creek, or a bunch of gay feathers. We played riding and weddings, funerals and tea parties, bush ranging and exploring with an election now and then. Of course, the happenings in the town, each in turn, suggested a new game, and I wonder if I ever went to Mother and asked her, "What can I play next?" The trouble was that my maternal relative was always interrupting my games to drag me indoors for meals or bedtime. Often an imaginary couple would be left at the altar half-married, or a funeral in solemn procession would be summarily dispersed just because of a parental decree that I must have a clean pinafore or eat a tasty and nourishing dinner. This kind of play had its advantages. It encouraged resourcefulness and was cheap, healthy, and satisfying. As I was the last of the family, and my sister next in line was nearly 8 years older than myself, it followed that I was obliged to make my own amusements as a rule, and to spend my happy days in our dear old garden, where almond and apricot hummed with bees in early spring, and the summer was a procession of lovely things. The coming of darkness. As stated before, the first few years of my life were filled with loving care, and with the conscientious effort to build up my mind as well as my body to the full. But the time now approached when shadows began to fall on us in more senses than one. My father's health began to fail, and his malady increased as the months went by. The brick portion of our house developed cracks due to the underground subsidences of old mining operations. A cement cistern for catching the rain for household use, which had been put down at a very heavy cost to us with our limited means, also cracked and would hold no water. Mother was forced to undertake more nursing and to be away from home more often, for Father could work only part of the time, and it became harder to make ends meet. My eldest sister was teaching by this time and stood behind her family loyally, while all the time it grew apparent that the old doctor was right when he had predicted total blindness for me. It became usual for me to shield my eyes from strong sunlight with my arms across my brow, and my little hands were ever out around me, searching for contacts to aid me in moving about the house and garden. Gradually it crept upon me, first a mist over everything, then a grey twilight through which objects showed indistinctly. Finally the world vanished, never again to be visible to the bodily eye. And by my 7th birthday, total eclipse of sight had fallen upon me. In deep distress, my mother was forced to realize the fact. She had kept watch, always hoping that the darkness would not be complete. But one day, holding up a bunch of flowers to me, it must have been springtime, for they were red anemones, she asked, "What have I got for my little pet?" Out went my hands to feel, and at that I was gathered to my mother's heaving bosom, and she kissed me over and over again, crying through her bitter weeping, "Oh, my baby is blind. She will never see the flowers any more." Fond, faithful mother, she did not understand in that moment of cruel anguish that memory has a more permanent vision than the eye, and that her little sightless daughter had stowed away 1,000 lovely pictures of earth and sky, of autumn's grassy velvet and the plumy trees along the banks of the creeks, and that among these pictures would be mother's anemones and lilac, the gold of the laburnum chains and the rosy softness of the almond blossom. Best picture of all is the recollection of her own smiling face as she sat with her children around the tea table on Sunday evening, with her husband at the head, listening calmly or joining in the chatter and the mirth. This gradual fading of the light seems to have made little change in my own view of things. I went on climbing fences and fruit trees, running errands for my mother, and sharing in the play of the neighbour children. I must confess that my guardian did not always know how venturesome were those games. We wandered into the bush, regardless of the number of snakes among logs and rocks. We played about the creek, walking logs that had fallen across the stream. We dared the dizzy heights of the poppet heads at a new mine opened up just behind the school. Perhaps the finest jaunts of all occurred when a fresh supply of pipe clay was needed for whitewashing the big fireplace and the kitchen walls. Then would I mount my chariot, a large box on wheels, and with Steve as horse and Sister Lizzie as outrider, we would gallop away for a full afternoon in the wilds, where a worked-out mine filled all the whitewash requirements of the town. With the spread of farming, entailing the destruction of native plant life and the infiltration of alien flora, with the clogging of the natural watercourses, with mining slum and dredging operations, a change had come over the land in most country areas like Carisbrook. Therefore, I feel that in recording such detail, the impressions of my childhood, both in this chronicle and in my other books, I am preserving something for later Australians, which may shortly be unrecoverable, if not preserved now. The country, the flora and the fauna, to which our pioneering parents came, is worth remembering, even if it cannot be saved in any other way. By the end of my 8th year, my father had left us for the higher life. The shadows of that period are still heavy and sad as I recall the pageant of death, the casket and the flowers, the mourning and tears, the crepe bands and the long cortege that followed our dear one to the cemetery. In these days I know there is a confirmed objection to including children in such scenes. However, I am not sorry to have known those solemn hours. for it has added to my experience, and we cannot begin learning the lessons of life too soon, especially as I am sure that the very young do not suffer in such matters the poignant grief of older people. Since then, I have had to farewell all my immediate family and to find myself the last surviving member. Yet it is life, and not to be long grieved over, for I have had them, and I've loved them all. And they passed on, like a million other precious things.
That brings us to the end of episode 2 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.